Hey y'all, how's it going? Welcome to the show. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Yep. All right. I'll get to talking now. I like this song. Hey, guess what? Bob Murphy's going to be on the show here in just a few minutes. I got to remind myself that. He's starting at the quarter after here. Robert P. Murphy from the Ludwig von Mises Institute. I'm going to ask him things and he is going to answer and it's going to be awesome. That's how the UT girls say it. Awesome. And then also Nancy Youssef is going to be on the show. She's working for McClatchy Newspapers right now out of Cairo. And McClatchyDC.com, that's where they keep her articles. And so I'm going to be asking her all about the Saddam Hussein level approval at the polls of the new Egyptian constitution. I don't know. I was going to say that silly thing about what a tangled web we weave, but it's not very tangled. It's pretty obvious what's going on here, isn't it? Well, I guess we'll see. Depends on who you are, what's obvious to you or not. I don't know. But, so Nancy Youssef, she's a good one. I like reporters, some of them. I don't like media people so much, but reporters, well, I like it when they report stuff. Depending on, you know, if it's true. If they're not just trying to lie me into war. But otherwise, you know, I guess I would be a reporter, except I'm not brave enough, right? Like, that's the difference between me and Michael Hastings. If he was like, yeah, you know, I'll take the risk that maybe I'll get blown up if I can go report on the war. And my attitude is, I will stay here in my chair and I'll talk to a guy like him on the phone. Forget that. Let Patrick Coburn, you know, deploy all the courage. I'll stay here and interview. Anyway, yeah, funny thing about Hastings dying in a car wreck instead of in a war. But that happens a lot, you know. If you read the press out of Killeen, you see soldiers killing themselves in car motorcycle wrecks all the time. It's hard when you're an adrenaline junkie and everything goes so slow, you know? Can be. Alright, anyway. So I respect reporters a lot, because I would like to be one, except I'm not courageous enough. I mean, I'm not going to sit around reporting on the, you know, local town carnival. If I'm going to report, it's going to be from a war zone, but no, I want to live. Not die, so. You can see how living as my overriding principle of life would sort of prevent me from... I mean, you look at what a dangerous year it's been for reporters in Syria. Were there 30 or 50 or... How many double-digit missing reporters are there? How many missing McClatchy newspaper reporters are there? At least a couple. I'm sorry, I'm only thinking of Austin Tice off the top of my head. Remember, we had our friend David Enders came on the show and said, yeah, I was kidnapped by the al-Nusra Front. You imagine that? They let him go. What was funny was I had interviewed David three or four times about Syria in the meantime, and he had just kept reporting without having written about or without writing about his kidnapping until quite a few many months later. And I thought, wait a minute, I've talked to you two, three times since you were kidnapped by al-Qaeda? Holy crap, dude. Yeah. Let the McClatchy people take the risks. You know, not that's not dangerous to live in Austin. Okay, yeah, it's not dangerous to live in Austin. Unless you're black and near a cop, in which case you got about a 50-50 chance of surviving, maybe. All right. Lots of news to cover, very little time, so I've already wasted a lot. Let me tell you real quick, I'm giving a speech at the FFF, that's the Future Freedom Foundation, conference within a conference, on February the 15th, at the Grand Hyatt in Washington, D.C. And that's a huge Students for Liberty conference with a huge Future Freedom Foundation conference within a conference. And it's going to be Jeremy Scahill, the author of Dirty Wars, and I guess star of that movie, Oliver Stone, and then a whole bunch of great people. Robert Higgs and Stephen Kinzer, and of course our heroes Sheldon Richman and Jacob Hornberger, and John Glazer and I will be giving a talk on libertarianism versus the empire. And that should be good. And we'll be taking your questions. So come on out, say hi. Gareth Porter's going to be hanging around. And like I said, Robert Higgs is one of the greatest humans in the world. And Stephen Kinzer. Man, if you get a chance to watch Stephen Kinzer give a speech, that's what you ought to do. I've seen him give a speech. It was about Cuba and Iran and America's back-asswards Cuba and Iran policies over the last decades. And man, it was good. It was real good. It was the kind of thing where you go, man, that guy, he can give a speech. Good. he's accomplished in talking. He might have gone to the, I thought I was going to think of the name of it. What do they call it? Where you go to the meetings every week and they, the Toastmasters. There you go. He must have practiced, that Stephen Kinzer. He'd be worth the price of admission just to see Stephen Kinzer give a talk. I'm sure it's all going to be in the third row for that one. All right. Anyway, so that's on the 15th. Okay, now news. First of all, this. Fareed Zakaria from CNN. He interviewed President, what's his name, Rouhani. Did I used to know his first name? I can't think of it. Anyway, old Rouhani, the president. So, they've only aired the teaser for his Sunday TV show. Making me wait 4 days? Come on. And the teaser is him talking with Rouhani, Fareed Zakaria talking with Rouhani, and Rouhani saying, no, we are not dismantling our centrifuges. I don't know who told you that. I'm paraphrasing. But no, that is absolutely not happening. I don't know what you're talking about. In fact, I did have the clip, but then I lost it, didn't I? Or do I have the clip? Ah, who cares about the clip? Fareed Zakaria then went on CNN and was interviewed by the CNN anchor and said, man, this is a train wreck. Holy crap, I could have swore he was going to say that they're going to bend right over and do whatever they're told now. Isn't that what's going on here? In fact, that was the CNN anchor's question, and that was what Zakaria responded was, yeah, this is a train wreck. I mean, believe me, the Americans think what they're going to get out of this final deal with Iran, right? We're in the midpoint now between, not really even the midpoint, but we're between the interim deal and the final negotiation. Much is still undecided. And Zakaria is saying, well, gee whiz, everybody in America thinks that what they're going to get out of this is that the Iranians are going to dismantle all their centrifuges, or at least a great many of them or something. And here he's saying, no, we're not doing that. And in fact, his language was, you know, pretty absolutely notly very hard to back down from. Now, of course, yeah, they can still just turn him off. They can still disconnect the cascades. And there are some weasel words and there's room for negotiation in there. But I think that Zakaria is pretty much on point about the American side of this. At least, you know, so far it seems like Obama is demanding everything short of a complete abolition of their enrichment technology and their Bushehr reactors. And he's going to let them keep almost nothing, is what it looks like so far. We don't know. That seems to be the American position. They're not going to demand a complete and total abolition of their nuclear program, but they do want it you know, very diminished in scale, you know, how much can be produced in what amount of time. And they want it to be inspected from here to the ends of the earth. And then there are some poison pills, too, which hopefully are just positions that are deliberately too far in order to be negotiated away. Like, they have to admit that they used to have a nuclear weapons program, which isn't really true. And they have to, you know, I don't know, maybe keep, again, go back to answering all the bogus questions based on the alleged studies documents, which are obvious Israeli forgeries, or... Anyway, it doesn't have to be a train wreck, but that's the spin. And the Americans, I think, would be more responsible than the Iranians if it ends up that way. Hey, all, Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs. The first ever QR code 1-ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. Hey y'all, Scott here. So you made a little bit of money in this horrid economy only to find that the Fed has more or less outlawed saving. So into the treacherous waters of the stock market bubble you go. But how to make a little money without too much risk of losing it all? Check out WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who opens a very real window into his main account, updating his subscribers on the facts of and the reasoning behind all his market moves. Follow along on paper or with real money and see what happens at WallStreetWindow.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and this is my show, The Scott Horton Show. My website is scotthorton.org. Keep all my interview archives there. More than 3,000 of them now, going back to 2003. And if you want, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /ScottHortonShow. And now to our first guest, Robert P. Murphy, author of The Politically Incorrect Guide to Capitalism and The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Great Depression and the New Deal. He keeps a blog at consulting by RPM.com, and of course he's a senior fellow or something or other like that at the Ludwig von Mises Institute at Mises.org, M-I-S-E-S, Mises.org. Welcome back to the show, Bob. How are you doing?
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Well, you're welcome. Very happy to have you here. Now, I think you may have seen this news story that the world's richest 85 people own as much wealth as the bottom half of the population of the planet Earth, which would be 3.5 billion people. And then the number is 1.7 trillion these 85 people own, the 85 richest people. And that's according to Oxfam. And so I was wondering, I mean, I really am a libertarian individualist anarchist type and not much of a commie, but it did occur to me that if 85 humans own as much as the bottom half of the population of the planet in terms of wealth, then maybe it would be okay to hunt them down and eat them. What right do they have to hoard so much from while so many people are so desperate? I mean, does that really make me a Leninist to say that, or what?
No, it doesn't make you a Leninist, and it's the difficulty with all this stuff, Scott, is that we don't know the exact circumstances under which this outcome was generated. And so if it really were just the result of purely voluntary transactions, and it was just, for example, you know, Bill Gates is obviously one of those 85 people, and it's not as if his creation of Microsoft and everything that he's done took food out of the mouths of people in Africa. You know, he basically created a lot of value, if you will, or wealth, just de novo out of his creativity, and so now Earth is richer because of what he did. And if you, you know, seized all of his assets, and it's not too like his net worth, it's not as if he's just swimming around in gold coins, or he has just a bunch of limousines and pizzas and caviar. It's largely his shares of his company, and so really his wealth consists ultimately of the assets that of his company, including the humans, who he's hired and trained in that network that he's developed. And so it's not as if you could even break that apart and give it away to people. It's not like there's a pile of medical services and food and housing that Bill Gates is hoarding, and then if you just took it from him and gave him to everybody else, then you could spread it around. So there are things we got to realize in that nature. But on the other hand, it's also true that I bet a lot of those people got their wealth through devious means, and that it is true that there are people you can point to in the world who have been made worse off because this particular guy became a billionaire through means that you and I would think are immoral.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, in fact, the McClatchy story about this has a picture of Gates standing next to Carlos Slim, who is the phone baron of Mexico. And my best understanding thumbnail sketch is that they used to have, you know, a Ma Bell commie type government telephone system in Mexico, and then they just gave it to this guy. And so now he's the world's richest man. But that doesn't seem right, really. I mean, if it was the people of Mexico who owned the telecom business, shouldn't they all have gotten an equal share when they privatized it, instead of handing it all over to this gangster?
Yeah, and I should confess that I'm not... I know the guy's name, and I am vaguely familiar with his background, but I don't know enough about it to say whether, oh yeah, this is clearly one way or the other. But it's certainly true. I mean, I can say that when certain state-run enterprises that were in the, from the Soviet, former Soviet Union, were privatized in quotation marks, that certainly there was a lot of corruption there, and they were basically just handing the reins over to the former party officials and so forth, and so it was a scam, and that really it was just the same old system, but just under a new framework. So, by all means, I am very sympathetic when leftists are very critical of privatization and they smell a rat. That's certainly true, but again, I realize I'm trying to have it both ways here. It might sound like, but nonetheless, the sort of naive libertarian free market people are correct when they say that the way to help poor people is not to grab stuff from achievers and give it to them, but rather to open up opportunity. So for the reason there are so many billions of people around the world near starvation levels of existence is not because there's 85 really rich people walking around. It's because their governments put obstacles in the path and don't enforce property rights and have all sorts of other mechanisms in place that prevent them from lifting themselves out of poverty through what we would call the market economy. Mm-hmm. So that's the reason you have worldwide poverty. It's not because there are rich people holding them down, except insofar as rich people are connected to governments and they're partially responsible for these bad policies.
Right. I mean, I'm not one to argue that, this is all the wealth of the laborers all expropriated by the bosses or whatever kind of thing. I mean, you're right when you talk about all of the new wealth that's been created by Gates and his company. And yeah, he got to write up the contracts that said how much of that was his share. But so that's all right, because that's, you know, what he did. He did it. But so he created all of that. But now, and then even again, you know, Microsoft, of course, has sweet deals with governments all around the world for providing the software for their computers and who knows what kind of thing. So it's not like he's a completely free market company, but at least it did start out as, you know, a real entrepreneurial thing, Microsoft. But now, so when you read that 85 people, I mean, are they mostly Gates's or are they mostly, you know, people like this guy Slim who just, you know, was basically the crook that ended up on top? Or who are these guys? 500-year-old banking families or what?
Again, it's not that I've analyzed carefully the biographies of all of these people. My guess would be that
I'm just asking for your ballpark estimate. I mean,
yeah.
Who do you think they're referring to? Like the king of Spain or who?
Yeah.
Like what?
I think 43 of them are good guys, Scott, and 12 are really bad, and the rest are just okay. Is that what you want? My guess would be that you're right, that it's largely people that oil interest, banking, and some computer moguls, obviously, things like that.
Yeah, Saudi sheiks.
Yeah, and so, and also the other thing too is it's kind of I don't know if catch 22. There's some kind of phrase I want to use. I'm not sure what exactly is applicable here, but like consider Bill Gates. My broad strokes on him, I think that you're right. He started out and wanted to be just a free market guy, and he was just a computer nerd, and it took off, and you know all of a sudden he was a multimillionaire and then a billionaire. And then if you remember, the U.S. government was going to crack down on him. They were going to break up his company. So, you know, we don't know what happened behind closed doors, but now, of course, Gates is doing all this kind of one-world stuff that all the other people, I'm sure you and I get emails from, saying, you know, Bill Gates is for population control and he's all this stuff.
I remember in the 90s where he had never had a lobbying firm before, but it was once they brought the antitrust stuff against him, he went and hired the best lobbying firm that money can buy, because he's got to now.
Right, so I mean, I'm not making excuses for anybody, but I'm just saying, if you get to become a billionaire in today's world, you have a bullseye on you, and the major players who run things, they're going to go have a talk with you and, you know, let you know you're going to join their system or they're going to take you out. I mean, look what happened, you know, in Russia. They just, you know, there was a rich guy there.
Look what happened to Lehman Brothers.
Right. So I'm just saying, it's because obviously if you're truly a billionaire that is completely liberty-minded and are going to do everything in your power to oppose the government and the system, they're not just going to let you get away with that. Yeah. So,
well, and thankfully, there's not too many like that. I mean, most, I think, well, I don't know, but it's got to be that the super majority of these guys, these billionaires, made their money off of public welfare one way or the other. You know, either banking bailouts or contracts for fighter jets that don't work or whatever crap, you know? It's got to be.
Yeah, I mean, just if you, in terms of the way the system is right now, I mean, it's kind of like saying, you know, when somebody is elected president, I don't even need to know who the person is. I'm pretty sure it's not a good guy or
yeah,
woman.
Or they wouldn't have let him anywhere near it in the first place. Exactly.
Right, just because I know the system and the kind of constraints there are. And
I mean,
someone
I guess you could have, like, maybe a video game entrepreneur who, like, you know, but even then, nah, army contracts for a lot of the video game industry, big time in there, you know? So it's all corrupt. It is. Hollywood, too, all of that.
Right, and what I was trying to get at with the Gates example is, even if you somehow did quickly just create something totally new that just took everyone by surprise, and, you know, you were an overnight billionaire, so they didn't have time to stop you and groom you, they could still just walk up to you and give you 19 different ways they could shut you down and put you in prison tomorrow. I mean, the government has all kinds of laws that you probably broke.
Right.
You know what I mean? If you have a company of that magnitude, I'm sure you did all kinds of insider trading and 19 other federal offenses without even knowing it, just because there are so many thousands of rules, and so they could easily threaten you and your family and so on. I mean, that's the thing, too. It doesn't even have to be legal, right? Given what we know these people are capable of, I mean, again, it's not that I have proof of this and that Bill Gates grabbed me in a bar one time and told me what happened, but I'm just saying, if there are all these rich people walking around, it's like a process of selection. If they are allowed to be that wealthy, then, yeah, my hunch is they probably are playing ball with the government behind the scenes to be able to continue walking around like that. So, when you see that outcome, the answer is not, well, let's give more power to governments to seize half of these people's wealth and give it to poor people.
Right.
That's not really what the solution is.
Yep. And then there's Doug Casey. But other than that, they're pretty much all got to be in on it somehow, right? That guy, he stands out for sure. All right, now, we're about to have to take a break here, but when we get back, I want to ask you about something else about Bill Gates, something he said the other day, that I think by 2050, there will be no more poor nations in the world. That's just the beauty of compound interest and new technology and whatever it is, I guess. And so when we get back, I'm going to ask you a little bit about that and, you know, maybe get a little bit of good news about the world economy, if there is any. It's Robert P. Murphy from the Ludwig von Mises Institute at Mises.org. They're the libertarian, Austrian anarchist. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. Hey, all, Scott here, inviting you to check out Modern Times Magazine at moderntimesmagazine.com. It's a great little independent publication out of Phoenix, Arizona, featuring unique views on economics, politics, foreign policy, sports, and music, with great art scene coverage and fiction writing as well. That's Modern Times Magazine at moderntimesmagazine.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Bob Murphy from the Ludwig von Mises Institute, author of The Politically Incorrect Guide to Capitalism and The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Great Depression and the New Deal, both of which are really great. And especially, you know, if you're a liberal and you like challenging your own views about how things are, I really recommend that you read The Politically Incorrect Guide to Capitalism, because it's very thoughtful. I mean, you might think, oh, yeah, that's a series of right-wing books I don't like or some kind of thing like that. It's actually, well, of course, it's Bob. It's very thoughtful. He thought of every objection that you were thinking of, and he answered that one, too. It's really in there. And maybe you won't love all of it, but I think that you'll really learn a lot if you read The Politically Incorrect Guide to Capitalism. And so, anyway, Bob, I wanted to ask you about a couple of things. Right at the turn of the new year, there were stories in, let's see, the Center for American Progress, you know, the Democrats, basically, the Think Progress blog, and then there was some, maybe it was the Wall Street Journal or somebody, I forget, but whatever, somewhere else on the spectrum, came out another report, and they were all saying, they were polite and didn't mention that America's wars and jihadi revolutions and whatever around the world are the exception, but otherwise, the world is at peace, and the people of the world are more prosperous than ever before, and the lowest of peasants in deepest, darkest Africa have more access to medicine and drinking water and education and technology and tools for improving their lives than people have any idea. In fact, I failed a test at one of the newspaper's blogs, had a test about how good I think, maybe that was the Center for American Progress. It was a test of how good you think the rest of the world is doing. And the standard of living is higher than you think, all over the place, they said. So then Bill Gates, I saw the other day, was saying there won't be such thing as a poor nation. He didn't say there will be no poor people. He said there will be no poor nations. And he left out war and revolution, I guess, there too. But there will be no poor nations left in the world by 2050 because capitalism. Simple as that. What do you think of that?
Well, I mean, certainly I think the trends are there that you do see a rise in the absolute standard of living among a lot of the world's poor people. And I mean, some of the greatest progress is being made in China and certain African regions where they had been racked by awful wars and maybe coming winding down, or in China, just they're certainly liberalizing there. So it is ironic, I suppose, that I think we tend to have a U.S.-centric look or Europe centric perspective, and clearly here our freedoms are going the other way, but in many parts of the world where they suffered horrible ravages of unbridled state power a few decades ago, they're going the opposite direction, so those people are on an upward trend. So I have no reason to doubt those general trends, and the issue was just, okay, that's great, but certainly that doesn't excuse the sort of things that the U.S. government's been doing, obviously.
Yeah. Well, and there's just a ton of gangsterism going on in all of this, too. And I think, I highlighted this to you in that email from the McClatchy story where they said, here it says, the report, and this is, they're referring to the Oxfam report where they did all these statistics and whatever, of the rich getting richer. And they said, and this is just, in the most recent history they're covering here. The report also said that while the recent financial crisis was an enormous burden on the world's poor, it ended up being a huge benefit to the rich elite. The very wealthiest people on Earth, again, minus Lehman Brothers, collected 95% of the post-crisis growth, the report said. So I'm not exactly sure what that means, but it sounds like what it means is that Ben Bernanke just printed money and gave it to the people who are already the wealthiest to prop up their institutions. And then while everybody else is broke and kicked off the unemployment rolls and everything else, they get to call it a jobless recovery and move on with their lives. Is that about right?
Yeah, so if for this particular example, with a much smaller time frame, I think we can be a bit more confident when we say the explanation for these broad sort of snapshot trends that they're documenting is not that, yeah, in the last few years, it just so happens that all these people in major financial firms are delivering a lot of value to the consumer, and that's why they're posting such huge gains. No, I think you're exactly right that it's because the Fed's bailing them out. And then if that is, to the extent that that is what's going on, that the Fed's buying up all of their mortgage-backed securities and the other toxic assets that they were sitting on that prevents them from going down, then that really is just a direct transfer that the Fed is making the average guy poorer by creating new money and giving it to these rich bankers, because obviously the savings of the poorer people are now going to be diluted with the creation of that new money. So I definitely think in this case I'm more confident in saying, yeah, that trend is ominous, and that is evidence of how these super rich people are gaming the system and benefiting from their power. But again, just to repeat myself, it's the solution to that. You know, I'm sure like somebody from the Occupy movement would see that and be outraged and then call for more government intervention into the economy to prevent this sort of outcome. But the point is, the reason these rich plutocrats can get away with this kind of stuff is because we have a central bank with such unlimited discretion that's not even tied by the gold standard or any other kind of constraint except what they think is in the interest of the economy. So, of course, when you create an institution with that kind of power, we shouldn't be shocked that they use it to bail out rich, politically powerful people, and then they didn't just start handing out money to homeless people.
Right. All right, now, I'm a crazy radical extremist, and I think that they should have not bailed out anyone at all back in 2008, whatever caused all those distortions, and you can talk about that if you like, that Citigroup and Chase Manhattan, J.P. Morgan Chase now, and all of those guys should have, if they were, you know, destined by the prices to cease to exist and be replaced by someone else in the market someday, then tough. But then again, you know, people don't usually listen to me about stuff like that, and they say things like, no, that would have destroyed the entire economy for everyone forever, and it would have been worse than the Great Depression. And like George Bush said, we had to operate against the principles of the free market in order to save the free market, because I guess there would have been a Bolshevik revolution if they had just gone ahead and not printed the money and let those big banks fail, Bob.
Well, I think if in 2008, you know, the fall of 2008, when Paulson and all these guys, and you're right, it is ironic that it was the Bush administration that administered all this stuff initially, that if some Southern American country's ruler had done that kind of stuff with the bank nationalization, you know, Fox News would have been calling that guy a fascist or a socialist and calling for us to invade the country, or excuse me, called for the U.S. military to invade.
Yeah.
So if you had told Americans when this stuff all started going down in the fall of 2008, okay, we're going to do this. We're going to bail out all these major financial institutions. And oh, by the way, 6 years later or 5.5 years later, we're still going to have a jobless recovery and people are still going to be biting their nails, not knowing how they're going to make ends meet. And it's basically going to be just a bunch of profitable returns to the financial sector, but everybody else is still going to be hurting. What do you guys think about that? And the federal government's going to be trillions of dollars deeper in debt, and the Fed's going to, its balance sheet's going to be quadruple what it is right now. How do you guys feel about that? I mean, I think everybody would have said, heck no, there's no way we want to do. Go ahead and give us the little depression you're promising us right now, but at least, you know, we won't corrupt the system the way you're talking about. So they were led to believe that this, they would have gotten through the crisis and things would have been back to normal a few years later. And yeah, they would have had to bail out some rich people who should have gone down, but that at least we were getting a healthy economy in exchange for it. But we've gotten the worst of both worlds. They bailed out the rich people, and then the average guy is still struggling years later.
Mm-hmm. And then so if I'm watching TV, and even on TV they admit that, well, there's some discrepancy. Some claims are that the unemployment rate is 13% or could be higher, and especially if you're talking about among minority groups, it becomes much, much higher and that kind of thing. Then on the other hand, they say, you know what, housing values are doing better than ever before and all that. Does that mean that right now it's just 2005 again and we're about to have another one of these giant crashes?
I don't know at what.
I mean, I don't see why a bunch of unemployed people would be putting a bunch of upward pressure on the price of houses. You know what I mean?
Yeah, oh, I know exactly what you mean. I think that's a great point. The way I look at it is look at the stock market. To me, that's even scarier than the real estate market. I mean, if you look at a chart of the S&P 500, it peaked in the 99, 2000, then it crashed. Then it went up again in 2007 and started coming down and so forth. And now we've surpassed that previous peak, but it certainly looks like there's three bubbles in a row, and we're in the middle of the final one, which is now even bigger than the previous two. And if you say, well, in the last few years, what was it? What was all the great economic news that would have pushed the S&P much higher than it was in the heady days of the housing bubble years? And certainly it doesn't seem like there's any great economic news to justify such huge valuations in the stock market. So to me, I think there's clearly a bubble. And you say, you know, well, when is it going to pop? I don't know. I mean, well, I can tell you for sure, if the Fed has to start raising interest rates because price inflation is getting out of hand, well, that will certainly pop it.
Right.
But when would that happen? I don't know. To be honest, I'm surprised we've gotten this far along, and it could be just because I'm a bad economist, or it just could be because we're in a huge bubble and the dollar itself is in a bubble.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, geez, if I had any money to invest, it'd be fun to see if I can put my money where my mouth is and figure things out. I told you before, I think, I know a guy who had a company building skate parks, and he just read the walls, I mean, for counties and cities, gigantic concrete, you know, monuments to skateboarding all across the West. And then he just read the Wall Street Journal every morning. And as soon as Ben Bernanke raised the federal funds rate a quarter of a point, he said, that's it. He put all his bulldozers and everything up for sale, cashed in, and sat back and placed short bets on the housing market and the banks who were invested in him. And he was just, in fact, I would say he was, you know, halfway versed in Austrianism, right? Like, he just basically knew about paper money and the bubble and how it works, the Rothbardian explanation. I don't know if he had read all of Man, Economy, and State or exactly what, but he knew about Austrianism, and he was placing real bets and was making real money, doing good like that. So, you know, people ought to keep an eye out for that kind of thing if that's what they're invested in, the housing market, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I still believe strongly that 10 years from now, looking back, people are going to say, I cannot believe just the mass illusion that Americans fell for again after having lived through the housing bubble. How could we possibly have thought that Ben Bernanke creating trillions of dollars of electronic money just through computer digits and bailing out the people who had made horrible investments and loaning money to the U.S. government so it could run trillion-dollar deficits, how could we have thought that was the path to prosperity? And of course, that just postponed the inevitable and made the crash that much worse. But when you're living through the midst of what you happen to believe is mass delusion, obviously the other people don't think so. Otherwise, they wouldn't be deluded.
Yep. Well, and then, so I guess, I don't know exactly how these things work, because again, I don't have any money to invest, but it seems like depending on how far out you can guess, it might be time to start placing those short bets on all these bad stocks, but keep an eye on that federal funds rate, right?
Yeah, and also I'm watching the excess reserves in the banking system. When they start getting lent out, that's a signal, too.
All right, there you go. Bob Murphy, consulting by RPM.com and Mises.org. Thanks very much, Bob.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it easy and 100% anonymous. Just deposit the money into their account at any Bank of America, Wells Fargo, or credit union with shared branching, and then just email them a picture of the receipt with your Bitcoin address and you get your Bitcoins. A simple, clean, anonymous way to get Bitcoins. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. All right. Welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Coming up, Nancy Youssef on America's satellite dictatorship there in Egypt. And so that should be good. And now here, let me cover some news for you, man. I'll try my best. I tried to get Jesselyn Raddick on the show today. You know, I always meant to read her book. She worked for the Department of Justice back during the John Walker Lind fiasco, and she tried to advise the Department of Justice that, whoa, wait, what you're doing is illegal. That was her job, was telling them whether their behavior was illegal or not. And they fired her. And anyway, so she's been really good on whistleblower issues, this kind of thing. She was one of the ones who went with Colleen Rowley and Ray McGovern to go and see Edward Snowden in Moscow. You might remember that from a couple of few months back now. So anyway, here she is. She's Director of National Security and Human Rights at the Government Accountability Project. And she is, in fact, a legal advisor to Edward Snowden. Okay, so now here's her piece in the Wall Street Journal. It's very important. If you can't get to it right away, see if you can put the title in Google News and then click the link from there, and you should probably be able to read the article, because, you know, they do their paywall. But anyway, it's Jesslyn Radick, Why Edward Snowden Wouldn't Get a Fair Trial. The Espionage Act of 1917 wasn't intended to prosecute whistleblowers like him or Bradley Manning. Which, actually, maybe it was, but shouldn't have been anyway. Espionage is espionage. Being a whistleblower is being a whistleblower. It's not like he's a Russian agent who's doing this to hurt America and he's just pretending to be a whistleblower. He's a whistleblower. Even if you don't think he should have done it because you don't think it's all that scandalous and worth revealing as many secrets have been revealed, then still he's a whistleblower that you disagree with. He's a whistleblower. To prosecute him for espionage, as Obama is attempting to do, it's a lie right to your face. Right off the bat, what else can you call it other than a lie to charge him with espionage? You charge him with driving the wrong way down a one-way street as long as we're just making up stuff, too. It's not espionage to be a whistleblower. Even a whistleblower that you think blew a whistle that you don't think should have been blown. It's still an espionage. And so anyway, here Jesslyn Radick is arguing that he would not get a trial. People keep saying, oh, if Edward Snowden was really a whistleblower, he would come home and face the music, right? Like Melissa Harris Perry said on MSNBC. Why doesn't he just come and it'll be just like a Hollywood movie and the courtroom will fall silent and let him give his giant soliloquy to the jury and then they'll let him go if they like him? Because that's America and justice and the law and red, white, and blue and stuff like that. And Jesslyn Radick is saying, no, that's not how it works at all. And let me see if I should read some of this or try to sum up her arguments here. She's got a few of them. She gives an example of Mr. Drake, who was another National Security Agency whistleblower, who was charged under the Espionage Act. And she says, the Espionage Act effectively hinders a person from defending himself before a jury in an open court, as past examples show. In the case of Mr. Drake, who disclosed massive fraud, waste, and abuse in NSA surveillance programs, the government moved to preclude the word whistleblowing from the trial. All felony counts against him ended up being dropped, and he pleaded guilty to a minor misdemeanor. Kiriakou, the first CIA officer to tell the media about waterboarding, could not tell the jury about his lack of intent. He accepted. She's under a severe word limit here. I'm sure she would have explained a little more about Drake. But anyway, they did end up charging him only with one minor misdemeanor at the end. And in fact, really, the judge yelled at them for basically persecuting this guy by trumping up all these charges against him, which just weren't true. Which, you know, that's pretty good. I don't think he ever got a chance to give a soliloquy or nothing, but still. Then here, Kiriakou, the first CIA officer to tell the media about waterboarding, could not tell the jury about his lack of intent. He was forbidden from telling them about his lack of intent to break the law by revealing classified secrets. He accepted a plea bargain on a non-Espionage Act count, and Manning's salutary motive and intent for revealing the military gunning down innocent civilians in Iraq as if they were playing Call of Duty was ruled inadmissible. Until sentencing, the court found Manning guilty. And now that's really important, that and she leaves out here, again, it's a newspaper column and severely space limited here. But the truth is that Chelsea Manning went to her commanding officer and said, hey, I am actually, being made to participate in rounding up innocent people for crimes no worse than writing articles the government doesn't like. And they're being hauled off to be tortured. And so I'm telling. And his superior officers, or her, whatever, Chelsea Manning's superior officers said, get back to it. And only then did Chelsea Manning take the secret and confidential level documents and smuggle them out of there and upload them to WikiLeaks after trying to go up the chain of command after being made to participate in war crimes. Literally, a guy had written an essay called Where Did the Money Go? About the Prime Minister, right? Can you imagine if a Republican wrote an article about Barack Obama called Where Did the Money Go? You know, about Solyndra or something like that. Well, where did the money go? Oh, you're now to be tortured to death. That's what Manning was being made to participate in for the government of Nouri al-Maliki that America and Iran installed in power in Baghdad. That was what caused Manning to be a whistleblower. Sorry for digressing a little bit there, but it seems like it was worth bringing up to me. Anyway, she goes on, but the point of the matter is that... Here she talks about how he won't be able to talk to his lawyers. Assuming Snowden came back, he wouldn't be able to discuss his defense with his lawyers except in a skiff, a secure compartmentalized information room, whatever the hell it is. And so then, no notes, no computers, no telephones, and it becomes... you know, much more difficult for them to put on a defense when they can only whisper in a secured facility. And then anyway, she goes on, actually, let's see here, the silent witness rule, where in the Dre case, the government tried to say that, listen, anything that wasn't classified, but that he should have known should have been classified, well, that counts as classified too. Huh? And on and on. In other words, if Edward Snowden came home, there would not be an episode of Matlock where his attorney gets to get up there and really make their case. Because what would happen is the government would win 700 times in all their pre-trial motions about what the defense is not allowed to say. Like, for example, yes, I did take the documents in violation of my secrecy agreement. But the reason that I did it is because I swore a sacred oath before God to protect the Fourth Amendment, the Bill of Rights of the Constitution of the United States. It's the only reason I had any authority in the first place at all was because I swore my sacred oath. And I thought that if the American people knew that their Fourth Amendment was being violated so freaking bad that they would use their democracy just like Thomas Jefferson intended in order to set everything right again. And so I thought, even though it was in violation of my secrecy agreement, that my oath to the Constitution and to the American people superseded that, and so I did what I had to do, so please find me not guilty because it was the right thing. No, that would be absolutely forbidden by the judge from even happening. Anything like that. As she mentions in the case of Manning, Manning was not allowed to argue intent until sentencing. I mean, that whole thing was a ridiculous, rigged thing. But anyway, Miss Raddick ends with, Espionage Act is for spies like Aldrich Ames and Robert Hansen, you know, who spied for years and years and decades within the U.S. government. That the U.S. government failed miserably for decades to prevent. That's what the Espionage Act is for. Actual acts of treason. You know, people like Jonathan Pollard turning over nuclear weapons plans to the nuclear war plans to the Soviet Union. Stuff like that. Anyway, so there you go. All those people who say, oh, well, Edward Snowden, if he's such a whistleblower, which means everyone on the right. Boy, don't y'all get tired of just repeating what each other say all the time? Everyone on the right, oh, he should just come home and face the music then. Oh, and all of the Obama bots, like on MSNBC, he should just come home and face the music. You know, Dan Ellsberg, I've interviewed him 100 times or something, and I know this story well. The only reason that Daniel Ellsberg didn't get life in prison, everybody, he's like MLK now, right? He's a saint. Everybody loves Dan Ellsberg. Everybody knows he helped end the Vietnam War that we never should have been in the first place. And thank God he finally did leak those Pentagon papers, right? That's the consensus. Well, the only reason that they let him go was because Nixon tried to bribe the judge with his Supreme Court judgeship. And actually they uncovered that he had hired Cuban hitmen to kill Ellsberg. And at that point, the judge said, just forget it and cancel the trial. Otherwise, he'd be doing life right now.
for being a hero, for doing the right thing. Universally accepted as the right thing, what Ellsberg did now. What was the only interest group in D.C. pushing war with Syria last summer? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. What's the only interest group in D.C. pushing to sabotage the nuclear deal with Iran right now? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. Why doesn't the president force an end to the occupation of Palestine, a leading cause of terrorist attacks against the United States? AIPAC and the Israel lobby. The Council for the National Interest is pushing back, putting America first and educating the people about what's really at stake in the Middle East. Help support their important work at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Our next guest today is Nancy Youssef from McClatchyDC.com. That's McClatchy Newspapers. Republished, of course, in the Kansas City, whatever, in the Miami Herald and newspapers all across the country. And is currently writing from Cairo. Welcome back to the show, Nancy. How are you doing?
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
I appreciate you joining us. And I'm right about that, right? That you're in Cairo?
That's right.
Okay, good. Just making sure. I was sort of talking out of my hat, but I thought I was right. So I'm glad that it turned out that I was. Okay, good. So, listen, the Egyptian constitution, apparently the people of Egypt really, really liked it. It was ratified in a referendum by 98%. Is that right?
Well, apparently is a very important word of that sentence, because really, no. And that, yes, it was ratified by 98.1%, and not only that, 20 million people nearly came out for it, more than those who had voted for ousted Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi's constitution a year ago. But the big difference was that this year there weren't the monitors and independent observers that were there in past elections, where there were 6,000 last year international monitors. This year there were only 200 at 16,000 polling stations. And so that's the record that the Egyptian government has put up, but there's no way to independently verify it. And in fact, there were quiet whispers that, in fact, what they were reporting was different than what some of those observers on the ground had seen. What was interesting about the statistics is they all showed overwhelming approval, even in places like North Sinai, which has been engaged in heavy gun battles with the government forces, and places like Fayoum, which were once considered strongholds of the Muslim Brotherhood. Even in those areas, it showed overwhelming support. Those who had voted, for example, in Fayoum, 89% for the Morsi constitution last year, voted 95% this time for the military-backed constitution. So It was either a rigged process, you ask some, or a resounding defeat of the Morsi and the Brotherhood brand of government.
Yeah, that sounds to me like they got LBJ to help them rig that thing or something. They have the graveyards all vote, too.
Well, that was the speculation. I have to tell you, I spoke to a senator a few days before the election, and I asked him that question. He said they are voting, referring to the dead. So who knows? But there's no way to independently verify it because, you know, in the past, I would go to the vote and watch the ballots be counted. This time, the judges were a lot more reluctant to let us in. They'd hold their IDs for longer. One judge would take a few hours to count the ballots. The next one would take 10 minutes. In the same polling station. And so it just didn't feel as open and as transparent as past elections had been.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, this was a war party talking point against Saddam Hussein, that his dictatorship was always ratified by 98 and 99%. That, I mean, what a joke is that? It's a lie on its face. Nobody agrees. You can't get people to agree what day of the week it is, 98%. Come on.
Well, I'll tell you what's interesting about this. You're right. I mean, those were Mubarak figures. Former Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak. Remember, he would win the election with 98% and similar figures. The difference this time was because there have been so many arrests and such a feeling of fear amongst Egyptians about speaking out against the government. It's possible that a lot of people voted yes because the alternative wasn't there. If you had a no pamphlet in your possession, you could have been arrested in the days leading up to the referendum. If you spoke out against the Constitution, you could have been arrested. And this was against a massive government campaign urging people to vote yes. It was relentless. You couldn't get away from it on the highways with all the billboards. You couldn't get away from it on television, on state radio. And so I have to tell you, for many people, the feeling was you could either vote yes or you could get arrested, but you couldn't vote no. And so that's what makes it very hard to assess what the true number is. But it does contradict the very polarized figures that we have seen in past elections. Morsi only won the election 52-48 a year ago, so it's hard to believe that there's been that dramatic a shift. But but is it possible the Brotherhood has lost support? Absolutely, and probable. How much? We don't know, and these figures aren't necessarily the most accurate way to get at that.
Right. But now, so the Brotherhood didn't attempt to really spread the word that they wanted a boycott or anything like that, or the opposite of that? Did they encourage people to try to show up if they could?
No, their official position was urging people to boycott, because from their perspective, if they put it in the process, they legitimized it, and there was a feeling that this was going to pass either way. So their version of events was, why legitimize it but participating in it? At least if we stay out of it, we're not suggesting that this vote and this count and this process are legitimate.
Mm-hmm. And then, did it seem like in real life those 2 days that there really was a massive turnout and everybody who, you know, anything like the 20 million that you're talking about, that more of a turnout compared to Election Day a year ago when Morsi did barely win?
Harder to tell this time, because one of the things that had happened between those two elections is there were fewer polling. So you never knew if the longer lines were because there were more people there or because more people were voting at particular polling sessions. Anecdotally, I can tell you it didn't have the same fervor as past elections. It didn't have the same suspense or optimism or curiosity or hope that this is going to lead to something.
Yeah, why stand in line for a fait accompli, right?
Yeah, that was for some people. Now, some people thought this was the path to stability, that maybe this Constitution wasn't perfect, but we needed to get back on track. Remember, the Morsi Constitution was suspended immediately after his ouster, that we needed to set a framework going forward. And for other people, this was a mandate on General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, the Minister of Defense, and really de facto leader of this country. So there wasn't an enthusiasm, I guess I'm saying, for the Constitution. The vote ended up taking on other meanings, the future of the country, the prospect of Sisi winning the presidency. There was very little talk about the substance of the Constitution. And when you talk to voters about it, they really couldn't tell you a lot about what they were voting for vis-a-vis the document itself.
Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of picking sides. Well, so what is in the Constitution? How different is it from the last couple?
Well, on paper, it offers more rights. Some of the more interesting things is that the new president cannot change the Minister of Defense to, again, a Sisi for 8 years, which was interesting. It calls for respecting women's rights more. It reads more liberally. It continues to protect the military as an independent institution that is not as monitored by the government. So rhetorically, it was, I think, a more refreshing document for those who wanted a democratic, more liberal state. The problem was that in the weeks leading up to this, we've actually seen a government that's cracked down much more aggressively on political opponents, that's cracked down on those who speak out against them, and has also arrested an astonishing number of journalists. And so whether those words bear fruit in terms of how the government conducts itself remains to be seen.
Mm. Yeah, well, you know, I wonder, I guess a couple of things there, and unfortunately we'll probably only have time for maybe half an answer, but about the police state as it is, you know, versus their real political enemies like the Muslim Brotherhood, but also just about the average, you know, government martial law reign of terror in Egypt as compared to how it was under Mubarak and or under Morsi. Has there been any real reform of the perpetual state of emergency and the secret torture police and all of that?
Well, there hasn't been reforms in terms of the police state. It's certainly there, and it really feels much more aggressive now, because from the government perspective, they are fighting a terrorist threat, one that threatens the stability of the country. And for them, any action that's required to put that down needs to be carried out. But they're actually doing a nationalist duty, and so that message has resonated with a lot of Egyptians, and so there hasn't been major change. But right now, there isn't the kind of widespread demand of change, certainly not that of the 3 years ago during the uprising or even during Morsi's period. There's such a desperate want to return to some form of stability that many Egyptians are willing to accept the government's actions, whatever the cost, to get to some point of stability.
Mm. Yeah, you know, I frequently speak with Adam Morrow from Interpress Service, and then and this was his take. And then the New York Times actually ran an article along these lines that said that when they did overthrow Morsi last summer, that magically all of a sudden the beat cops started showing up for work and doing their jobs and providing a modicum of basic security for the people of Cairo, which is something that had been completely lacking, basically just their refusal to go along with the Muslim Brotherhood administration. Was that your sense too?
Yes and no. I mean, remember, these are police forces who've been trained for decades that the Muslim Brotherhood is their biggest enemy and the biggest threat to their country. And so you can imagine the adjustment that would have happened for any police officer who'd been trained this for all of his career.
I'm sorry, Nancy, I have to interrupt you, and we have to take this break. Can you hold on just a couple of minutes? We'll
sure.
be back and do one more segment.
Absolutely.
Here. It's Nancy Youssef from McClatchy Newspapers. That's McClatchyDC.com. Officials accuse Muslim Brotherhood of trying to cripple Egypt. Is at least one of the latest. I'm not sure if that's the very latest. Anyway, back after this. Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right, or the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm him. I'm talking with Nancy Youssef from McClatchy Newspapers, writing from Cairo, Egypt. And before the damn commercial break interrupted us, we were talking about how the Muslim Brotherhood has always been a group that is the enemy of the state of Egypt, and that didn't really change when they were elected to power there for about a year or so. Is that right, Nancy?
Yeah, it was definitely a challenge that I think a lot of the security forces faced. Certainly not uniformly. There were police on the streets during Morsi's tenure, but the remnants of what we call here the deep state were certainly there and arguably pervasive. And so I think it was a very difficult transition for them. Now, when you talk to police officers, and in fact, I just visited the police station yesterday in downtown Cairo, they will tell you that these political prisoners are a bigger enemy and a bigger threat to Egypt than the criminals that they have there, and they look upon them that way. They'll openly tell you that.
And now, tell me this, because it seems so strange to me. Well, and, you know, what do I know about Egypt? But just from a very vague kind of perspective here, it seems strange to me that the liberal, more socialist, labor union, April 5th movement types decided that they would prefer to side with the military rather than making an alliance with the Muslim Brotherhood, if it was at all possible, because then at least what they would have in common was a future of elections that one could put a little bit of faith in, and you win some, you lose some. But that seemed to be, there seemed to be a consensus that that's really what they wanted, and they sided with the military and decided they would prefer to have a military dictatorship as long as it kept the damn Muslim Brotherhood out of power. And so I wonder, just how bad was the Sharia law that they implemented in Egypt? These guys are the second coming of the Taliban, or what?
No, it's a great point, actually. It's worth remembering that there was an alliance early on. Ahmed Mahar, the April 6th founder, had
right, back 3 years ago at the beginning,
days.
Right.
That's right. But there was a feeling that the Brotherhood treated the presidency. There are some presidents who think that they have to check in with their public all the time. And then there are others who think there's only one moment of accountability, and that's election day. And Morsi was the latter. There was a feeling amongst the Brotherhood they had won. They treated it as though they had won by 80% rather than the 52%. And they were openly unwilling to work and accommodate and work with liberals and other groups. And for those liberals, they felt really betrayed that they had stood together, they had helped bring usher in Morsi's presidency, and now their views weren't being taken into consideration. And so it led to this growing and anger towards the Brotherhood amongst liberals. Then you had an economy that wasn't improving. Frankly, Morsi made a lot of unbelievably stupid mistakes, wasn't very charismatic or nationalistic. He only and often only spoke to those who voted for him. And there was a feeling he was polarizing the country. And then millions took to the streets on June 30th, the one-year anniversary of his presidency. And the military had the only institution that could have had rescued, from many people's perspective, the country from Morsi and in the sort of divisive and frankly incompetent way that he was running the country. And so that's why it's been so hard for these guys to reunite, because they feel betrayed by them. And now a lot of these Brotherhood are in jail and are not able to lead anyway any sort of formidable opposition to what's happening here. So those are the two factors that have come together that have made it very difficult for liberals and the Brotherhood to come together in any real way.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, so what about the role of the American Pentagon in this? Because, of course, the U.S. is a world empire, and Egypt is one of our satellites, and their military has been very close to ours for a great many years. But then again, those things can change somewhat. Has the relationship changed in the last 3 years? Has it changed back?
Yes and no. I mean, Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel has, I believe, engaged in 34 phone calls with General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, and it certainly hasn't led to any substantial change that we can see on the ground here in terms of not cracking down on political dissidents as much. There has been some break in that military relationship, but the reality is that the military here is the strongest institution in place, and there is no real challenge to it. And so the United States has continued to work and court that relationship and urge the Egyptians to take on a more democratic transitional process. Secretary of State John Kerry released a statement after the referendum and couldn't even endorse the process because of all the concerns that we've discussed. And so You are seeing a break in terms of the rhetoric, in terms of the amount of times the U.S. government is pleading with the Egyptians to embrace a more democratic process. But at the end of the day, there is no alternative to them. Mm-hmm. And they will remain a formidable force in this country for years to come.
Yeah, you know, I seem to remember from a couple of years back talking about this, or maybe 3 years back, about how the military, really those generals, they are the 1% who control the whole economy of Egypt, really, from all the tourism and whatever, agriculture and anything else. It's all in their hands. And so that makes them the center of all power in you know, throughout the society, really.
That's right. And before all the events of the Arab Spring, it was considered the most nationalistic institution. It was one of the few places in Egypt where somebody could rise from the limited means and become an influential figure in their country. It really embodied Egyptian nationalism in the face of a government that didn't always respond to them, the civilian government, that is. It was the most Egyptian thing in place, all while having an economy, the military economy, nobody even knows what percent of Egyptian GDP it accounts for, because they don't have to release anything publicly about their financing. But they have gas stations, they provide products, they have businesses. So they are the nexus of not only the Egyptian security and Egyptian government, but the Egyptian economy.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, so what do you see as the kind of medium-term future of their democracy here? I mean, they got this new constitution. You think they're going to the elections for the new parliament, the new president, are they going to be anything like fair? Or I guess they're just going to exclude the political right from running, or how's that work?
Well, the big question that sort of that's kept Egypt in suspense right now is whether Sisi is going to run for presidency. And if he does, the presumption is that he wins. And if he doesn't, nobody can really name somebody who could step in and fill that slot. And so everything sort of hinges on that question, whether he runs. And from there, we'll have some sense of where the country goes. I am feeling the smallest signs of a break in terms of the wholehearted endorsement that the government has had for the return of the military, from those who are starting to fear what's happened, what's happening in our country. Are we returning to a police state? I think one of the reasons that Egyptians were willing to endorse the military return is that there was always this feeling in their minds that since 2011, we can take to the street. That despite everything that's happened, the street hasn't been taken from them. And I think there's a feeling that if the government goes too far, they can still speak up. And I think that's where Egyptian sort of hope in the future lies. And so we'll see how the military balances its governing in the face of this crackdown and how much Egyptians consider acceptable and necessary to return to a stable state.
Mm-hmm. And now, could you tell us a little bit about what's going on in the Sinai Peninsula? Who are those guys?
Well, I should point out the Sinai has always been a part of Egypt. They don't even get most government services other than water. And there have been jihadists there. Part of it is ideology, and part of it is just it's become the business there, trading through the tunnels to Gaza and whatnot. And under Morsi, there was a feeling that the government was much more lenient on those residents in North Sinai. And once Morsi was ousted, the military cracked down quite heavily on them and has rounded up thousands of people. The problem is there we're seeing potentially the reemergence of jihadist elements who once were attacking Israel and now are saying that our target is the Egyptian government. You'll note in September there was the assassination attempt on the Minister of Interior, and there's a suspicion that they are sending arms and explosives throughout the country to try to destabilize it in this increased battle with the government.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I wonder whether you think it's possible that the maybe younger and angrier members of the Muslim Brotherhood or would-be members of the Muslim Brotherhood are going to end up fighting in insurgencies and joining forces with the kind of people you're describing in the Sinai Peninsula since they've been frozen out of politics so badly.
It is something I worry about. You know, we're writing a story today about women detainees who are arrested for protesting, and you talk to them and you meet with them, and you can feel this increased anger. Their feeling is, you know, we tried the democratic process and it was taken from us. We tried protesting and it was taken away from us. And you can feel this growing anger and jihadist rhetoric and talk that they need to get back, and not to retaliate on behalf of the Muslim Brotherhood, but for their brother, their uncle, their father, their son who's been arrested, for their own arrest, that it's become much more personal, because we're talking about thousands of people who've been arrested since Morsi's ouster. So it's no longer about ideology, I think, for a lot of them, but really personal vendettas and the potential for that to turn into something violent. You certainly feel the undercurrents of that in Egypt today.
Mm. See, I'm a reverse truther. I think the Americans work for Al-Qaeda and that everything we do is just meant to make them look right about us and boost their recruitment.
I don't know, but I couldn't say about that. I mean, I can only tell you that I think the government and its relentless push to go after jihadists and to return things back to status quo where the rules were sort of understood and the Brotherhood was kept underground, that they've been so aggressive that there's a potential for reverberations and retaliation. And in the long term, certainly in the short, medium term, as we go in a few months ahead, the ground seems fertile for sort of persistent instability. Now, how you frame that, whether it's a war or an insurgency or occasional violence, is yet to be seen.
Yeah. Well, let's hope it stays minimal. All right. Well, thank you very much for your time. I sure appreciate it very much.
It's my pleasure.
So I said very much twice back to back like that. It sounded stupid. But anyway, I meant it very much. Nancy Youssef reporting for McClatchy Newspapers from Cairo, Egypt. We'll be right back after this. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future of Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right. Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome to the show, y'all. Back to it, I mean. She's great, ain't she? Nancy Youssef. I've been reading her for years and years, and it's funny, you know? I do this a lot. You might notice I have the same guests on all the time. I'm actually a little bit shy about inviting new guests on the show. And I got so many that I already know, you know, cover every war in the world, but I should be better about that. Getting new people on the show. That's only the second time I've talked to her. She covers Libya, too. She covers lots of stuff. McClatchyDC.com is the website there. All right. So, tomorrow on the show, foreign policy stuff, mostly. Okay, so, there's three al-Qaedas in Syria, and, I think the State Department says you're supposed to like the Islamic Front best out of the different al-Qaedas in Syria. So now the other two being ISIS and Jabhat al-Nusra. And so Jabhat al-Nusra, they say, is kind of founded by al-Qaeda in Iraq. But then again, yeah, it seems like maybe they're a little bit more Syrian, but they're still suicide bombers and prisoner beheader, bin Ladenite, Zarqawiite, bad guys. And then you have ISIS, and they're al-Qaeda from Iraq, the Islamic State of Iraq, they call themselves ever since Zarqawi got killed. And anyway, that's who they are, al-Qaeda in Iraq. And so they've gone up there, and now some of the rebels, some of the other rebels, the Sunni Arabs of Syria that are in a state of uprising, well, they don't really like these ISIS guys so much because they're not from there, and yet they boss everybody around like they're from there. They had the same problem among the Sunni Arab population of Iraq. Many of them were foreigners from Syria, actually, back then, and from Libya, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and other places around the region where they traveled to Iraq to fight as al-Qaeda in Iraq against the Americans. But the Iraqis, I guess, who joined up with al-Qaeda in Iraq, who have now gone to Syria, and this, I guess, their group includes the Chechens and the Afghans and whatever other foreigners tend to fall under their umbrella. So, and then you have the Islamic Front, and now the Islamic Front, we're supposed to believe, is the new FSA, the FSA being the ridiculous fake secular sock puppets that never really existed and are basically just a bunch of well-paid, big, fat expats who've been living in Virginia for 20 years and now are posing as the leaders of some kind of rebel force. But anyway, just after we talked with Mitchell Prothero last week, did he say this part on the show? I was scratching my head trying to dig to the part where I remembered whether he mentioned this on the show. I interviewed Mitchell Prothero, a great reporter for McClatchy, about what was going on in Syria. And then I think it was, didn't I interview him on the 17th? Sounds about right. Well, right after that, he put out this piece saying, oh, you know what? The top leader of the Islamic Front, which is supposed to be the third but less al-Qaeda-ish of the three al-Qaedas, he admits that, yeah, he's an al-Qaeda guy too. He has been. And so, yeah, but oh well. The question is, which al-Qaeda guys in Syria are least likely to eventually kill Americans? And so the State Department's bet was maybe they could work out a deal like that with the Islamic Front, where you guys can be prisoner beheaders, suicide bombers. Just promise us you won't ever go geographically any further west than you've already gone. Thank you very much. And by the way, we'll give you some money and some guns if you'll help fight against ISIS and or al-Nusra. And then the question was, well, I mean, to me, it seems like, you know, the Islamic Front is just another name for al-Nusra anyway, right? When the last of the FSA sock puppet, you know, gambit fell apart, where'd this Islamic Front come from all of a sudden? It's just al-Nusra, right? But then, so as Hillary Mann Leverett was pointing out on the KPFK show on Sunday, Robert Ford, the American ambassador, tried to meet
with the Islamic Front. See if he could give them some money and some guns for making these promises, like I just mentioned. And they wouldn't meet with him. And then, oh, good deal, because it turns out their leader says, yeah, I'm an Al-Qaeda guy, too. These are the people, you know, I'm not saying that it's okay for the Alawites to be a dictatorship of Syria. I'm just saying it's not up to me. It shouldn't be. Not that the U.S. government is me or that I really have any say in what it is that they're doing, but you understand. If I don't have a right, then the government that claims its sovereign power comes from my consent and will certainly doesn't have that right either. How could I delegate a right I don't have? That wouldn't work. So anyway, the U.S. government has been over there all this time trying to figure out, you know, which group of suicide bomber, prisoner beheader, civilian slaughtering jihadists they ought to be putting more money and guns behind. Should it be al-Nusra or ISIS or the FSA, which no longer exists, or say maybe now the Islamic Front? And now they're having this meeting in Switzerland over Syria. Except the rebels aren't there, or only sock puppet rebels who have no power and influence over the actual rebels who are doing the fighting. So you have, and of course there's a big controversy about how they invited the Iranians, who of course are the, you know, them and Russia are the primary patrons of the Syrian government there. They were then uninvited. But so what's to be worked out other than, I guess you could have the Americans and the Russians try to come to some agreement, but the Americans don't have the ability to do anything other than stop giving guns and money to the suicide bombers. They can't tell the suicide bombers to stop suicide bombing. They can only stop backing them. They could tell the Saudis and the Qataris and the Turks, enough. We're not backing the rebellion anymore. You know, because we got Putin to agree to not give Assad, you know, ABC weapons that he wanted or something, you know, some kind of agreement like that. Well, the Saudis and the Qataris and the Turks, they could stop backing the Al-Qaeda rebels too. But they can't turn them off. They don't control them. They don't own them. They're a bunch of suicide bomber prisoner beheaders. Who the hell's representing them in Geneva? Nobody. And by the way, another great article. I'm sorry that I'm just McClatchy guy. I mean, it happens to be that I get their morning email. And I like even Roy Gutman, who I disagree with. I like Roy and him and Jonathan Landay and Nancy Youssef and now Mitchell Prothero, before him our friend David Enders. I mean, these guys are great reporters, you know. And Landay, he's the guy, boy, if you've been paying attention to him back in 02 and 03 and 01... and 02 and 03, there would have never been an Iraq war, because he truthed you right out of it, except nobody was paying any attention. He was writing for Knight Ridder back then. But anyway, you can read his stuff from, man, right after 9/11, where he's absolutely on point about these kooks trying to lie us in a war with Iraq. And good the whole time, the first to write about the Office of Special Plans and all of this. Anyway, so he's got one saying, hey man, you know, here in Tartus, Syria, many Syrians still see Assad as indispensable in saving their country. And this is something that I haven't mentioned often enough. And not that I'm a Democrat, and not that I really believe in majority rule or anything, but I think it's important, and I think you should know, that a majority of Syrians actually support Assad. Now, I have been telling you this all along. Pepe Escobar talked about this from the very beginning on the show, and I try to remember to mention it when I can, but the Alawites, the reason that their 10% dictatorship of the country lasts isn't just because they're the officer corps of the military. It's because they have the support of all the different Christian factions and all the different Shiites, which the Alawites are sort of kind of a kind of Shiites, but really they preexisted the Shiites, but they adopted some parts of Shiite, whatever. But anyway, so they're down with the Shia. And then you got the Kurds, and the Kurds are a bit split. But then among the Sunni Arabs, who really are a super majority of the country, really, like 70% of the country, they're Sunni Arabs. Well, some significant portion of the Sunni Arabs, they support Assad too. The ones who don't are the ones who want to create an Islamic state and outlaw the beliefs of everybody else. And so you could basically argue
the reasonable ones among them, they're still part of the dictatorship coalition. As bad as that sounds, but it's better than them all getting their heads cut off, which is the future they have coming if Assad loses, they figure, and they have good reason to believe that. And, you know, by the way, if you go back just a few months to when, oh, no, there used to be some moderates, but geez, not anymore. But if only John McCain had gotten his way and we had backed the moderates back then we wouldn't be dealing with three al-Qaedas. We'd be dealing with the moderates and the three al-Qaedas. And the moderates would be whooping those al-Qaedas for us if we'd only armed them and given them enough money. Well, John McCain's moderates over there, they were the Northern Storm Brigade, and at least one of them openly admitted on video to Time Magazine, and you can find it online, that if you just Google Northern Storm Brigade, it's one of the first things that comes up, is John McCain's best friends saying that, yeah, I fought in the Iraq War against the Americans. What? That means he was a Zarqawiite back during the Iraq War, one of the foreign mujahideen who went to go and fight in the Sunni-based insurgency against the American and the Iranian-backed Shiites, the Badr Brigade, and all them. So, and these were the people where John McCain went to Syria, said they're so moderate, he wanted to spend the night. Dan McAdams said he wanted to have a pajama party. And you know what? That's not some scoop that somebody claims. That was John McCain's, you know, little smithers, Elizabeth O'Baggy. Remember the fraudster, the pretend PhD, who was trying to lie us into war? And who McCain was citing in the Senate saying that it's a tiny minority of the insurgency or Islamists. What are you talking about? They're all secular. And he was citing her for that ridiculous lie. Well, she was the one who organized McCain's trip to Syria. She was the one who told Politico. You can read the quotes yourself. It came from her, not a secret anonymous source exposing McCain. It was his little friend who said, yeah, Senator McCain wanted to spend the night with the Northern Storm Brigade at their little hideout, you know, where they hold their kidnapping victims and whatever. But we had to talk him out. Security intervened. So don't let him fool you with, if only Obama had intervened sooner in support of the moderate rebels. There never were any. America's on the side of Zawahiri in this one. Hey, y'all, Sky here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org, nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. Offnow.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. Running out of time. I better complain fast. Don't want to get all my complaints out. Hey, check this out. Remember back when we almost had a war with Syria? You know, on behalf of the three al-Qaedas? Back last August, September? Remember that? Well, there were a lot of people at the time, especially our good friends Phil Giraldi and Gareth Porter. They were pointing out that this is nonsense. There's no reason to believe in it. And in fact, isn't that funny? The intelligence report that they put out is not a CIA report. It's a intelligence report. Well, what the hell does that mean? oh, that means it was put out by the White House, and they use a bunch of CIA-ish language about we judge with confidence this, that, and the other thing. But it was the White House staff who wrote that thing. Or, you know, some lackey on the National Security Council. It was not a CIA product. And then we found out from Phil Giraldi in the American Conservative Magazine that there was a revolt among the CIA analysts who threatened to resign before they put out a report with their name on it and CIA Analyst Division stamp of approval on it, saying that, yeah, we're sure that Assad did this attack with chemical weapons, the so-called casus belli in that war we almost had. Well, ever since then, all the information has come out, casting more and more doubt. And even the New York Times has had to retract all the evidences that they had put together to back up their conclusion about where these rockets came from, where they must have come from, and this, that, and the other thing. And McClatchy, D.C. has a story from, oh, you know what, I don't think I have it here anymore, dang it. No, I'm sorry, I cleaned out my serious section since then, but, there was a new report that came out, I think just last week, early last week, it possibly could have been the week before that, but I think it was early last week in McClatchy newspapers, where, these guys came out, and basically the conclusion is that these rockets couldn't have flown more than a couple of 3 miles at the most. And the conclusion that Assad must have done it was based on the theory that they had traveled 9 miles. Well, not in this universe, according to these munitions experts. And I'm not the world's expert about this. And you know, Gareth, I don't think, ever really did do the complete Gareth-ian debunking. But Seymour Hersh in the New York Review of Books cast a lot of doubt on it. And there's been other reporting, too. And anyway, you know what? I guess my claim is that I have not gone through everything they ever wrote about it at Moon of Alabama. I bet if I did, I would agree with them. I think, you know, the complete disbelief of the government's version of what happened there is certainly the right stance to take, you know, from the beginning. I'm not saying that couldn't be ever, you know, disproven, but they should get no trust whatsoever on a casus belli like that. Oh, you know, our sketchy intelligence seems to indicate where some chemical weapons came from. Hell no to that. It's amazing the American people did say hell no to that and got their way on it, too. But you know what? I'm not the world's expert on this. I never even read a complete Gareth Porter debunking because he never even really did one. Not yet, anyway. So, you know, I can't say 100,000% what I know, but here's what I do know. Boy, they got a lot of reasons to disbelieve compiled over there at the Moon of Alabama. And boy, oh boy, even at McClatchy newspapers and the New York Times, they say things like, geez, you know, all of the premises of our argument have now fallen apart. And so therefore, scratch your head a little bit about whether maybe our conclusion is no longer a solid conclusion. Think about that. We almost had a war on that. The only reason we didn't have a war on that was because the people of America said, absolutely hell no. And you know what? A big part of that is all the ridiculous stuff about Barack Obama being half black, you know, Black Panther, Afro-sporting, radical, Marxist, Islamist terrorist from Kenya and all of that crap. The fear that right-wingers have that he is some other. When in fact, of course, he's a half-white, conservative, centrist, Democrat, nationalist, imperialist, warmonger, welfare-for-banker type, you know, just like the rest of them. But anyway, that fear, that... Whose side are we on in Syria again? I don't think I even want to find out, said the Republican base, that Tea Party base. And so then all the Republican congressmen were like, why should I support an Obama war? It was left to crusaders like John McCain to try to, you know, carry that for the right. But the base of the right was against it. Talk radio land was against the war. And the phones were ringing off the hook. They really were ringing. It wasn't just the proportion. It was the volume. People were calling Congress and saying hell no to that war. And so lesson learned. We can all say hell no to a war if we want. And we can all disbelieve or at least cast a sketchy raised eyebrow kind of a view toward any claim that this chemical rocket must have come from the base that we say it must have come from. Forget you and your must. We don't believe in that. Show us some footage of some Japanese Zeros attacking our base that we stole from the Hawaiians earlier, and then we'll believe that. Some trajectory, you know, azimuth that you claim you calculated. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Get back to me when you come up with a real good reason why America ought to be Al-Qaeda's Air Force, as Dennis Kucinich called it. He sure had that right. All right, now, man, so everybody's talking about some pop star on the cable news channels today, even on CNN International. I hate that crap so much. I don't want it in my brain. I just hate it. And what if I heard one of those songs and got stuck in my head? I still don't know a single song by any of these people, and I don't want to know. So leave me alone. So I went flipping through the channels, and the first thing I found was DEA on the Spike channel. And holy crap, are these guys just a gang of criminals? It's so funny. I almost want to, like, offer to sell them some PR advice that, like, dude, you guys should pretend to be professional at all. It is so blatantly obvious that you are worse criminals than the people that you're busting for simply participating in the drug black market. Are you kidding me? Some guys transporting cocaine to Wall Street for a bunch of bankers to snort, and you're going to destroy them. Life in prison. You're facing life in prison unless you narc on everybody else, boy. It's amazing. It's like watching Cops 20 years ago, only now it's 20 years later, and wow, man, we really have slipped down that slippery slope bad. Where they just are, I guess, getting these thugs straight from the pen and then making them DEA agents. Like, these are the scum that got fired from the ATF for, you know, being a rapist. The lowest dregs of the federal police community. And then they go, yeah, we got a bunch of high-level drug busts. And then, and yet all the footage that they can come up with is of street-level dealers selling personal-sized quantities to addicts. And they go, yeah, flex muscles. We win. We're winning. We're badass. And in fact, the one criminal DEA agent, thief, even admits that, you know what separates us from them? The rules. We have to follow the rules. They just make their own rules, but we follow the rules. Which is a great admission by him, that that is the only thing. And of course, their rules say that they can do whatever the hell they want within any limit, including kill people or do whatever they feel like. They're among the most corrupt agencies in all of the federal government, and everybody knows it, so never even mind the rules. But that's his admission, that there is no other difference between the guys who run the criminal black markets, who after all have to be pretty ruthless, violent criminals in order to be the leaders of markets the government makes black. So he just outright says it. Well, you know, the difference between me and the scum of the earth? I'm doing what the U.S. government says. Yeah, that's about right. I should flip through the channels more. Good old Spike TV, I like you guys, man. I got a whole new appreciation for what scum the DEA are. Not that I didn't already know that. You know, they act like they're proud too. It's funny, they tear apart all 18 of the wheels on an 18-wheeler. Because their informant said they're going to find some meth in there. Yeah, like nobody knows where to find any other meth than that they're going to bust. They take this 18-wheeler apart. All 18 wheels off. They search each and every last one. After 12 hours, they got nothing. And they're still proud. They don't even know that they're supposed to be embarrassed about what stupid idiots they are. And so they're still sitting there posing for the camera. None of them ever said to the TV producer guys, hey, let's not run this episode because it's about what jackasses we are. No. They went ahead and were like, yeah, dude, we're like winning against the drug black markets. Really? Man, it's a, what, $90 billion a year business, man. You guys aren't doing that. If anything, you're just by making the market black, you're changing it from a $40 billion a year business to a $90 billion a year one. And I'm just making up those numbers, but still. That's the only thing this accomplishes, is ruining the lives of the powerless and driving the price up so that the most ruthless make more money. And of course, whatever companies sell guns to the cops for a living. That's just another form of welfare. I'm all for the right to bear arms, but you should be selling your guns to the private free market, not being a welfare whore selling AR-15s to the cops for them to shoot Americans with. What kind of sickness is that? Oh, it's an assault rifle if you touch it. But, oh, try to take the machine guns away from the cops. Boo, freaking who? I'm sorry. Not that an AR-15 is a machine gun. They have machine guns. You know what I'm trying to... Semi-automatic rifles, they all have. And anyway, I just thought, what a joke. Here we are, since Roosevelt. But since Nixon with the... and Reagan with this drug war. It's so ridiculous. It's such an obvious, ridiculous thing. I mean, except for all the horror and grief and pain and destroyed families and destroyed lives and people raped and killed and murdered and cops paid with the money of people who have real jobs. Other than that, it's hilarious how stupid it is, and everybody knows it. Okay, see you tomorrow.